Hey, thank you and welcome back. You are listening to Something I Don't Know, a podcast where two best friends...
And Tyler
tell each other fascinating stories based on a wide variety of subjects, the only constants being that it is interesting, it is true, and it's something that we think that our friends don't know. My name is Colby Weeds, and with me, as always, is my lovely co-host...
Hi, it's Jordan. Each episode, Colby and I will tell each other a true story based on a wide variety of subjects, the only constant being that it's interesting.
Yeah, no, Colby just said that.
Did you say that?
Did you
take my part, you fucking asshole.
Okay, I think we should leave this all in.
Okay, listen to me. We tell each other stories. They're fun. You like them. We have our friend Tyler here. Let's talk about it. I don't have time. Colby was an hour late to the pod. We're busy. Let's do it.
Yeah, no, honestly. So
let's just talk about it. You and me.
Yeah. So I come to the homie's crib and
oh my god, how many times can I say sorry?
7:30, by the way.
Yeah, no, I was there like right around like 8:05 or something like that. And I couldn't remember Colby's buzzer, so I texted him and nothing. I texted him again, then nothing, and then I was like, just about to text Jordan, and then Jordan texted me, and she's like,
hey, where are you
with Colby? Because I'm not with Colby, and I can't get a hold of him. And then I was like, oh, so you're at the bar? I guess I'll come.
So then we had some drinks.
Yeah, we had a drink, and then we decided just to,
I was napping.
We decided to have a drink, and then we came back here. And
SIBK Studios.
And
yeah,
we
wanted to do a little quick buzz. Maybe that would wake him up.
And nobody was picking up the buzz, so fortunately Colby lives on the second floor of his building and I just yelled his name.
Just screamed and then, Colby.
And then he angrily answered, what?
He was mad at us for waking up from his nap.
We were well into the apartment before he realized that he was an hour off schedule.
You were literally in here and you're like, dude, it's 9:00. Like, I thought
you thought
fully,
it was like 6:45?
Yeah, I set my alarm for 8:00 and I assumed what had happened was you guys were just early and I had slept through you guys calling me. And
so he's like, it's this buzzer number. And we're like, yeah, dude, we know.
Yeah, so you guys get in here and you're like, it's 9 p.m. And I looked at my phone and I was just like, oh, yeah, no, I'm the asshole in this story for sure. I fucked up.
Should we put it on Reddit? Or am I the asshole?
I zonked there, apparently.
He was suitably mortified, which actually goes a long way.
That's fair. That's true. If you're a little embarrassed by the thing you do, I'll let it go so quick. I hate confrontation so much. I'll be like, it's fine.
As long as it's like, I don't care if I'm the bad guy in a story, as long as it's kind of a funny story.
That's true.
Thank you for joining us. This will be our second guest episode.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for joining us, Tyler Rowe.
Thank you so
much. It's lovely to have you. We've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, I've been very excited about this one.
Well, I hope I don't let you down. I'm really excited to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
I guess we should talk about how you know us. We met 5 years ago.
Has it been that long?
5 years ago, we started working together, and we hit it off, I think, pretty exceptionally well.
Pretty much right away.
It was pretty immediate.
That's true.
We've had this conversation before about, I mean, it comes down to, like, feminism and a lot of things, but there's not many things that men have it harder than, but I think one thing that men, it's a hard time for guys when we're adults to make friends as adults, as men.
Yeah, I always have a joke that's like, men go golfing because they're scared to just ask their friends if they want to go for a walk and chat.
I think that's 100%.
Men go camping because we're afraid to have sleepovers.
Yeah, like, that's like, I just want to hang out with you for a couple of days. Do you want to go in the woods and do it? Yeah,
where right. We could murder each other,
and
maybe.
So no one can see.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely no record of us being friends.
No one can prove this. We're going to be off the grid, bro. Yeah.
But we met, like, you know, in our, you know, mid to late 20s, early 30s, and we became friends, and that's a very difficult thing, I think, for adult men
to have.
Well, yeah, I totally agree.
Unless you're playing sports or getting a new job, it's hard to make new friends, I think, as a man.
Yeah.
Or if you work at a construction yard and find somebody to do crack with.
I think that's probably a lot easier, to be completely honest, than just, like, asking your friend to hang out. If you guys both want to do crack, you both want to do crack. It's not a friendship thing.
You're right. It's built in.
Yeah, this is not about, hey, maybe this guy and I can, like, share our deepest, darkest fears. It's, hey, maybe this guy can share crack with me.
Maybe this guy knows.
And
we
have shared our deepest, darkest fears.
And crack.
And a lot of crack.
So much crack.
So much crack cocaine.
So much.
Oh, God, I love crack cocaine.
So, without further ado,
da-da-da-da.
Our second guest ever on Something I Don't Know, Tyler Rowe.
Take it away.
Gosh, good to be here.
Do you know what he's doing?
Not at all. Do you know?
I know.
What the hell?
He knows a little. Okay, so.
This is colluding. You guys colluded.
Yeah, no, no, there's no.
I know what he's going to tell us. I don't know anything about it.
I'm furious.
This was kind of unavoidable because Colby and I have literally watched the thing I'm about to talk about together. Okay. So, like, he just kind of knew. But
I also think, and like, correct me if I'm wrong here, but just, we share a lot of similar ideals and similar ideas, and it's just like,
We have some major taste overlap.
The two of them are very same.
The Venn diagram is getting close to a circle. And it's just like, I think when you approached me with your original idea, you were like, hey, are you going to do an episode about this one day? Or do you do an episode about this one day? And we settled on, like, you came to me with something you're like,
don't do this because I'm doing this.
But it, like, when he mentioned what he was going to do, I was like, that is something that I will A, never do. And B, if I did, I know you would do it better than I ever could.
All right, go ahead, Tyler. Take it away.
On the bright side, I'm going to do it okay. So, how much do you two know about battle rap and rap battles?
Wow. I'm going to start because I obviously know the least. I've seen the movie 8 Mile.
It's literally written into my script to stop you before you say 8 Mile or, you know, Brittany Murphy or anything else.
I love Brittany Murphy. You know, I love her so much.
Well, she sucked at rap battles. Carry on.
Everyone listen to me for 1 second. She passed away tragically, and I think about it once a month, it ruins my day. Okay, here's the thing.
She was an angel.
She was so good. I've watched 8 Mile, so that's about as much as I know as, like, your typical white girl. Like, I really haven't gotten into the depths of it.
Okay, that's a good start.
Stunning. Colbs, what about you?
What do I know about battle rap?
Yeah, probably a lot.
I wouldn't say a lot.
Not just battle rap, but rap battles. I hope to show that they are kind of the same thing, but not really.
Mm-hmm. I would say, I think I would know more than you would expect were you to look at me.
That's very fair.
I did grow up listening to rap. I love hip-hop as an art, and throughout my friendship with Tyler, I've certainly seen more of kind of that end of things. So I've learned a bit about it, and I do find it fascinating.
Totally. Me too, actually. I respect rap a lot for someone who doesn't really listen to it. But I'm here for, like, female rappers. Like, I like Nicki Minaj and Cardi B because of the way I am.
This is going to basically not cover women at all, and that's kind of on purpose.
Okay, sure.
It's not because they should be not included in the conversation.
Yeah.
It's just because if I was going to start, like, making that part of the conversation, this already long conversation would have been way too long.
Yeah.
So, I'd like to begin by saying that this is not meant to be an exhaustive history of the subject by any means, but, like, more of a series of stories that hopefully has a through line.
Cool.
It's a topic that's so vast that it could easily be its own podcast series. And
undoubtedly.
And maybe you come back and you do a couple.
Well, shucks, I don't know. But, well, Jordan. But
I'm ready to go.
But I've been a dedicated fan of hip hop and I think a student since the 1990s because I am very old. And even so, I'm really not qualified to speak about a lot of these topics. And a lot of people have seen Hip Hop Evolution on Netflix. Maybe they've even read Ed Pisker's comic book Hip Hop Family Tree, which is incredible. There's going to be some stuff in here that listeners and maybe you guys have heard about, and hopefully a lot of things you won't. So I'm going to start actually way before the start. There's a lot of disagreement about exactly where the practice of rapping actually began. There's sort of a proto-rap that we could point to, the Griots of West Africa. We're talking about philosophy and spiritual teachings over top of musical beats a long time ago, by some accounts, like as long as a couple thousand years ago. There's actually like a traceable line of Griots that began in the Malian Empire in like 1300 or 1400 AD.
No way.
Yeah, their lineage can be traced back all the way to today in places like Mali, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, Senegal, like West Africa, so to speak.
Yeah.
So you can, Colby, you can kind of think of these guys as like multi-class bard clerics in D&D. Some Griots are actually famous, popular recording artists today. Guys like Youssou N'Dour or Mamadou Diabaté. These guys are like famous ass musicians even here in North America. Anyways, without getting too much into music history and African American history, the tradition of oral, historical, and spiritual storytelling continued through Black music as like slave spirituals, then the blues, blues, then rock and roll, then jazz poetics.
You know, all the good music.
I was going to say, everything that's sensational.
Every good song you've heard.
Yeah, for the most part. And also, without getting too much into linguistics, like putting it simply, all kinds of groups create dialects. This goes a long way back in human history. Sure, and these dialects, these dialects are often formed on class lines, on racial lines.
Definitely.
Geographically, like white people from Boston don't sound like white people from Houston.
No.
And black people from Boston often don't sound like white people from Boston. And totally. People from Manchester sound totally different depending on what social class they're from, if it's like an English thing.
That's the wildest thing about the English accents. They have 100,000 different kinds.
In the 1970s in America, it was only black people who like really spoke in the rhythmical and often rhyming way that they did. There wasn't that much of a cultural overlap then, which we enjoy now, largely as a result of the success of black music, in my opinion. Back in the 60s, if you thought about like listening to Muhammad Ali give an interview, he rapped every time he spoke in front of a mic.
He was incredible in front of the microphone.
Yeah, and like he's the greatest of all time, and he might be a bit of an extreme example. This kind of speaking, though, is not uncommon in black communities. So when we get into rap, when DJ Kool Herc figured out how to use two turntables to loop the breakbeat off the same funk records and played his first party in his apartment building rec room, it wasn't that far of a stretch for somebody to just start talking shit over a beat.
Even you just saying that now is like quite poetic. It's like quite lovely.
There's a rhythm to it.
Yeah.
This was on August 11th, 1973 at 1520 Sedgwick Avenue in the South Bronx. I mean, for sure, like guys like James Brown or Jill Scott Heron, they served as inspiration for early rappers, but these parties and the invention of DJing as we understand it today laid the foundations for rapping as we know it now. After people learned what Kool Herc was doing, the art form spread really fast. And
how do you spell Kool Herc? Did you spell him like really dope way with like a K?
With a K. And Herc is just like short for Hercules, like H-E-R-C. Sure.
So he's just like Kool Hercules?
It's just Kool Herc, yeah.
Love fuck that. Yeah.
He's still dope, by the way.
Because like the worst thing about Hercules is that he wasn't cool.
He was
famously not cool.
Hercules, the Disney movie?
Cool. Yeah, lame as shit.
If you like Hercules, you're cool. Colby's stupid. He didn't have a good childhood. No, it wasn't him.
If you like cool Hercules, you're cool. How about that?
Yeah, what about cool Hercules?
Continue.
Yeah,
that he had to separate himself from regular, not cool Hercules.
All right, so after people learned... After people learned what Kool Herc was doing, the art form spread, and guys like DJ Red Alert and Grandmaster Caz, and of course Kool Herc himself, started throwing bigger and bigger parties. DJs would even bring their equipment to local parks and basketball courts on nights where they weren't performing at nightclubs to square off against each other, and these competitions were called DJ battles.
This is all in the Get Down. Ooh, you like it so much.
Oh, there you go.
This has got to be, like, one of the coolest times to just be alive.
Totally.
Like, can you imagine living through this? I'm went to go play basketball with your boys, and these two random DJs show up and start fucking battling.
And one of the coolest parts, and, I'm literally skimming over this part.
Of course.
Because there's so much to say.
Yeah.
But, like, one of the coolest parts was, like, originally, before DJ techniques got really, like, advanced, these dudes just, like, it was, like, whoever could buy the most speakers and be louder than the other. Like, it started out as just, like, brute force.
Totally.
So with that said, nowadays, rappers are the stars, as we know. But back then, DJs were. And they acted as their own MCs at first. But as DJ techniques got more and more complex, they would eventually kind of hand off that responsibility to their friends. The first party rapper ever was DJ Kool Herc's MC, and his name was Coke LaRock.
Awesome. That's a great name.
Like, the best party name for New York in the 70s.
Totally.
Like, perfect.
Because,
you know, like, disco was happening. Everybody was at, you know, like, Studio 54.
Yeah,
fucking Coke LaRock. That's the dopest
perfect.
Shit.
Perfect.
Very cool.
In the Venn diagram of what was happening in New York, he was right in the middle.
Yeah, he was right there.
Yeah, it was like
right
art there. Scene. Hip hoppers partying.
Coke
LaRock. Coke LaRock, right in the middle.
Yeah, and he was also like a total innovator. So like I'm not gonna talk about Coke LaRock much, but he was one of the reasons that
do
we
next
have
time
rap.
You're on.
Okay, fair enough. So the early MC was like he was like a comedian, he was part hype man, and he was part battle rapper, even before rapping as we understand it now even existed. There was storytelling and jokes and hype for the DJ, a lot of it. But also, like, one of the biggest parts about rapping early was that the other crews were not as good as my crew. that the other crews, in fact, were whack. which is kind of the point of this whole story.
That's kind of I think that's kind of the point of Rap.
Well, that's what we're going to try to dissect. Yeah. The genesis of Rap was competition.
And sure.
While not every song that is a rap song is a battle rap, every song that is a rap song contains some element of battle rap. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about today.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
So with that said, and I get to ask you this a couple times today because I really wanted to, have you guys ever heard of the Roxanne Battles?
The Roxanne Battles. I don't think so.
Or also known as the Roxanne Wars.
No, it sounds cool though.
I will safely say I have not.
No, me neither.
Okay, this is going to be fun. So
it already is.
Well, I was excited. So this early rap group called UTFO, they had a hit in 1984 called Roxanne, Roxanne. Yeah, go ahead.
UTFO?
UTFO.
What does it stand for?
I can't remember.
That's none of your business.
Also, I'm upset at you for asking.
Yeah, fuck you, Colby.
Unidentified... thick flying object? I call you a thick flying object. What up?
Honestly, I think that I had it written down and I deleted it by accident.
You said, forget anyway. It. We don't need it.
No one's going to care what that stands for. God damn it, Colby.
All right. So this early rap group called UTFO had a hit in 1984 called Roxanne, Roxanne, where the song is about each of the three rappers in UTFO trying to become intimate with a woman whose name I can imagine you can guess. It's Roxanne.
Yeah.
Nice.
Before I go any further, this is great. My favorite lyric from this song is when the second verse comes out of the chorus in response to the first rapper, Kangol Kid.
Oh, I know Kangol Kid.
His attempt at wooing our sweet titular Roxanne.
I bet she's titular.
I was hoping you'd say that. The second guy who raps, his name is Educated Rapper MD.
He has,
what? Yeah, Educated Rapper MD. This is important.
He's a doctor?
Yeah, no. So he goes, you should know she doesn't need a guy like you. She needs a guy like me with a high IQ. And I guess that like that was Educated's whole thing, just to be the dude who reads.
He's like, I've read a book. What's
yeah,
up?
Yeah. So anyway. In the song, Roxanne brushes off all of her three young suitors. And that's how the song ends.
Roxanne, you cold bitch.
No, I love her. She's a queen.
Yeah. It's basically like every time me and the boys have gone out in search of love on a warm spring evening, UTFO gets an F for satisfying endings, but an A for realism. You know? Like, so now keep in mind, like, this song wasn't dissing anyone. It wasn't aimed at any other rappers. It still contained elements of battle rap because they did diss one another a little in the way that the other guy wasn't able to get Roxanne, Roxanne.
Sure.
But it wasn't a battle rap song. It wasn't even particularly unkind to Roxanne. She was like a pretty empty character, but at least they wrote her as a rational agent. Rap has been much less kind to women over the years in many, many instances.
No way.
In this case, really just like, hey, like we all want to date Roxanne, but none of us could. Ha,
yeah,
ha.
Yeah, that's kind of the song. And in competition battle rap in particular, which we'll get to, like, things are often much less kind to women.
You don't say.
But...
What? Hip-hop having a misogyny problem?
All right. But anyway, this song was just a song. You know, like, they that didn't stop a relatively unknown Marley Marl from deciding, and you guys should know Marley Marl if
I
you
sure
don't,
do.
From deciding this would be the perfect jumping off point for his career. Nobody really knew who Marley Marl was yet. He already knew a girl named Shantae Gooden, whose rap name was Roxanne Shantae, and she was from the same neighborhood of Queensbridge as him, and she could rap. So Marley Marl asked her to come over and record a response track over the very same UTFO beat, and which is actually a genius move because the song was already really popular on New York radio.
So they were like, what's up? We're going to spin it around.
Yeah.
Do you recognize any Marley Marl?
No, but I'm happy to be here.
You would know him from Biggie Smalls?
I know Biggie Smalls.
What's the line?
Everyday Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Marley Marl.
I need you to know that we're working with a very limited knowledge of hip-hop for me. So
that's okay.
Anybody you say that you think I know that I don't.
So Marley Marl and Roxanne Shantae, they use this UTFO beat to record a sort of response track. And Roxanne Shantae acts on this UTFO track, like UTFO were talking about her the whole time, and she just
cool.
And she just shreds these three dudes for being lame and not worth her attention in any way. Roxanne Shanté was 13 years old at the time.
Whoa!
They called the song Roxanne's Revenge, and the single sold 250,000 copies.
Holy shit. What?
This is in 1984, when, like, records weren't even really getting distributed widely outside of New York.
That's so, great.
In a hip-hop response from a 13-year-old girl,
decimated sold that many.
He sold 250,000 records. This is how Marley Marl started his career. Well, not exactly, but it was the big jumping-off point career, for him. Yeah.
Kickoff.
So...
Awesome.
So
13?
So, naturally, ooh. UTFO make a response track to the response
to
track.
To the child.
They make this response track. It's called The Real Roxanne. They didn't even make reference to Roxanne Shanté or Marley Marl or, like, really do anything untoward. They just tried to, like, take back, like,
the narrative.
Yeah, they tried to have Roxanne preeminence. And
did Sting say anything about this?
this ain't got nothing to do with Sting.
All right.
So then Roxanne Shanté doesn't care for this and responds again. And her and Marley Marl make a track called Bite This, which is also about the Roxanne song initially.
Hell yeah.
And in the rap tradition of making space for oneself, she didn't just come after the real Roxanne and UTFO. She goes after Curtis Blow. She goes after LL Cool J. She goes after Run DMC.
I know
she
those just, guys. Okay. She just,
what did they have to do with this?
Yeah, they didn't.
Fuck you all.
She just brings out the street sweeper and just starts spraying dudes. So this
kid, this 13-year-old, like, what up?
Well, also, like, you know, like, Marley Marl's a genius, and he's like helping things along. But
I
she,
love that.
But she is, like, probably...
She was one of the first to go at rappers the way rappers now go at rappers? Like, just dropping names until they respond?
Well, we're going to get into how that's kind of the whole point of rap entirely.
Okay.
So, this spawns, like, a whole host of other Roxanne-themed tracks from people all over New York. This starts spreading like wildfire.
Awesome.
And marks a major moment in rap history. And was also one of the earliest instances of the grand rap tradition of increasing record sales by being part of a publicized beef. It also led into another major rap beef between Marley Marl's Juice Crew and KRS-One, Scott LaRock, and D-Nice, also known as Boogie Down Productions, a year later.
Boogie Down, sounds great.
This was called the Bridge Wars Battle because...
KRS-One is super legit.
Yeah, like, one of the greatest.
He's a goat.
He's a goat. They called it the Bridge Wars Battle because Boogie Down was from the South Bronx and Juice Crew was from Queens, and those boroughs are only a few miles apart and separated by a literal bridge. And actually, Boogie Down is slang for the South Bronx because that's where hip-hop was originally created in the 70s, like I was saying before.
Cool.
Was where one went to Boogie Down.
Hell yeah.
Mm-hmm. Back to this beef. Like, I mean, not to get bogged down in the specifics, but KRS-One from BDP, he literally had a lyric.
Again, a goat.
He literally had a lyric that said, "Roxanne Shanté is only good for steady pumping," which is wildly disrespectful. And soon after, and this is about like early 1987, late 1986. Let's remember that the original song came out in 1984. So this has been going on for years.
Is it known by them that, like, is Roxanne at this point just, like, a figurehead, or is it actually that 13-year-old girl?
It's kind of both.
A little of column A, a little
of
column B.
It's kind of both.
I don't care for column A, but the column B is fine. Column A is a little weird.
Yeah,
so
a little
whack. It's like early 1987, probably, and Shanté runs into KRS-One at a bank and gets in his face about it.
Hell yeah, she does. Baby.
Yeah, and KRS-One even later admits in an interview, a televised interview, that he had no idea what to say or how to defend himself. He was clearly just like somebody who got caught up. In the event of the Roxanne battles and what they'd become. And by saying her name and speaking about her that way, things had gotten personal.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, I think that you can make an argument that Roxanne Shanté started it. But it was...
at this bank.
But, I mean, it was very obviously what Roxanne Shanté was doing, like, more playful in nature until that point. That KRS-One kind of, like, took it over the edge.
Yeah.
So...
You implied that I was only good for having sex with. I'm about to scream at you in a
not
bank.
Not just good for having sex with, good
only
for, like,
good for
using for
that's
sex.
That's true, using for
you
sex.
You know, like, it's not great.
No.
So,
also, a real good name. Roxanne Shanté.
Yeah, gorgeous.
Yeah, good name. So, Roxanne took it personally, and honestly, like, fair's fucking fair. And now she does, like, a full-on Boogie Down Productions diss track. comes out of Juice Crew, and Shantae responds to the KRS One line. She actually had a bunch of really good lines in that song, but she responds to the specific line by saying, "I'm an all-star like Julius Erving, and Roxanne Shantae is only good for steady serving."
Well, you which tell is them.
Which is like especially for like 87, that's dope. Yeah. So it's still dope, actually. So Roxanne Shantae had developed a taste for rapper flesh, and she wanted more. And she just started making diss tracks about everyone near her, like Queen Latifah.
So many.
Okay, so by now, this is literally going national. Ice Cube is dissing Roxy on a song all the way out in L.A. Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre's a song by Snoop and Dr. Dre called "Bitches Ain't Shit." You may have heard of.
I know that
is
one.
I've been told that bitches aren't shit by those guys. I do recall that. Yeah.
No, they ain't. And this is a direct reference to Roxy's "Brothers Ain't Shit,"
really?
Which is a song that she recorded.
No way.
Yeah, this is all in response to this. So in the end, there were 55 songs that got significant radio play in at least New York City, if not nationally, that were specifically about the Roxanne battle ending almost a decade later, and countless more that never saw airtime, which is crazy. So all of this came from one song that wasn't even a battle track in the first place. It was a song about some dudes having their advances rebuffed by a made-up woman.
Who then became a real woman.
A real child.
Who then, a 13-year-old who like really took the shit personal.
Well, and some people gave her some reasons to be fair.
Yeah, they sure did.
That's fantastic.
Now, there have been many smaller instances of the entire rap community converging over a moment to make a mark on a challenge that's been issued.
Sure.
Probably the best recent example being the Big Sean song "Control."
Okay.
It has a guest appearance from Jay Electronica, but much more importantly, a guest appearance from one Kendrick Lamar. In 2013, this song was released, and Kung Fu Kenny was already making a pretty firm claim to being the best young rapper in the game. Good Kid, Mad City had just come out the year before, and it was a smash hit. And I remember I was already irrelevantly old by the point this came out, but me and my old ass friends knew this kid was the truth right away. Mm-hmm. So on this Big Sean song, Kendrick laments that there isn't enough competition in hip hop anymore, and that even though he's friends with all the artists that he works with, he would still prefer for them to know that he could mop the floor with all of them. He says that if they aren't Jay-Z, Nas, Eminem, or Andre 3000, they don't even belong in the conversation with him. And then Kendrick goes on to specifically list his friends who he's talking about, and then says that he's trying to murder them so thoroughly that no one will ever want to hear from them again. This list includes J. Cole, Pusha T, ASAP Rocky, Drake, Tyler, the Creator, Mac Miller, and Jay Electronica, and Big Sean, who are the two other guys that were on the song. Trigger fingers turn to Twitter fingers, to borrow a Drake line. Rappers actually
the best Drake line of all time.
Maybe. Rappers actually responded with their own songs, showing their unique skills and styles over the same Control beat, and the conversation around that dominated rap music that year. There were dozens of good responses and many more terrible ones. And with that said, I would like to play that song for you guys.
Yeah, let's hear it. I've never heard it. I just love that he rhymed Decepticon with Lindsay Lohan. That was a huge
I did enjoy watching you get really excited for that part. Yeah, that
and fun. This isn't the same, but I do want to bring this up. But it was Monster by Kanye West on Beautiful Darkness of Fantasy.
Really like are you talking about Nicki?
I am.
It's so
where
good.
Nicki Minaj's verse in Monster was clearly not only the best verse on that song,
but the best verse in her rap career, probably.
It was, yeah. And one of the better verses on that album. And it's that album so is a good. Masterpiece start to finish. And there was, when it was produced, Kanye had a moment, apparently, where he was like, I don't know if I want to put this song out, because that verse
it's better than anything I've ever done.
It's just better than anything we have on this record. And
yeah, the only other verse on that record is from Pusha T, on So Appalled.
And it's
which is,
Pusha T.
Which is actually one of the guys that Kendrick just mentioned
said,
on that
hey,
song.
Hey, just so you know, you're not better than me.
And the Roxanne battles were really just the beginning of what became one of the defining aspects of hip-hop. There was 50 Cent versus the Game. That was a good one. Mm-hmm. In a much more lopsided affair, that was 50 Cent versus Ja Rule. rest in peace, Ja Rule.
I just think they're still alive.
There was 50 Cent versus Kanye. Mm-hmm. 50 Cent is a notable turd. one of history's most overrated rappers and a Trump supporter. Yeah. But he knows how to monetize rap beefs. Basically, like, the entire second half of the NWA movie, which I assume we've all seen.
I'm so sorry you haven't seen God. It. I'm trash.
Well, I haven't either.
Oh, you're trash.
Really?
Never mind. It's me. Huh.
I assume that I've seen this. And
and perhaps our listeners who are cool.
Anyone knows a bit of culture?
The second half of the movie chronicles NWA versus Ice Cube after he left the group. And I think it's fair to say that Ice Cube, who makes children's films,
I was going to say
now,
makes Disney movies
by
now,
the way,
yeah.
Is like one of the most vicious diss lyricists of all time.
No way.
Some of his works towards the rest of the group were brutal.
Crazy stuff. I give him the solid win in that whole altercation. But I will say this. Ice Cube is a straight up media mogul now. And the lessons that he learned leaving NWA and getting fucked by Eazy-E and Ruthless Records, they definitely informed the way that he would go on to do business in the future, which leads us into future beef. The very public and diss track laden battle songs between him and Cypress Hill never would have happened if he hadn't stolen material directly from Cypress Hill to use on his song Friday, the title track for the soundtrack of the movie of the same name. Ice Cube asked Cypress Hill to make a song for the Friday soundtrack, and then didn't want the Cypress Hill track that Cypress Hill had tried to put forward for the soundtrack.
Yeah.
And then Ice Cube kind of like stole their chorus for the song that he ended up using.
Oh no! Now,
like rap beefs that start,
that's not cool.
Rap beefs can start artificially for sure.
Yeah, sure.
But rap beefs
for publicity and for whatever.
Yeah, but rap beefs do start in earnest, and this is one of them.
Yeah.
And it did still increase record sales for both parties, but this particular one very nearly, and this is real, and we're not going to get into it, but very nearly sparked a straight-up black versus Latino race war in Los Angeles.
No!
And the reason we're not going into this is because this is a whole podcast. So, there's more beefs. There's
so many beefs.
There's Nas and Jay-Z. They're friends now.
That's what I was actually going to bring up. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you.
We're actually going to skim the shit out of this one. So
fully, but who do you think won?
I think Nas won because he was always... Or, pardon me. I think Nas had the better moments in that beef, but Jay-Z projected so much more confidence and, like, kind of was winning in terms of sales in a way that could lend legitimacy to his claims that he kind of won. So like for me as a rap fan, I think that you could have either opinion. In my opinion, I think the Nas had the better digs in that beef.
I agree.
But I think that Jay-Z overall won the beef, mm-hmm. just like, you know, objectively.
I think in terms of the rap they put out, I do think Nas won.
I would take either argument. But anyways, they're friends now.
Same.
Yeah.
They made a song.
Jordan's with me on this one. So yes. Obviously, that's the winner.
They made a song together in the mid-aughts called Black Republican, which just celebrated how rich they are.
I can't even be mad at that, no, to be honest. Yeah.
But they wrote diss tracks for one another starting in 96. And that shit spilled over to other people's records and all over the New York rap scene for like a decade. There's a lot of good recent ones. Some recent good ones include Drake. A lot of Drake.
Drake and Meek Mill.
Everybody knows
that.
Oh,
yeah. I know a little bit about that because Nicki Minaj was involved and I like Nicki Minaj.
Yeah. It's not your world tour. It's your girl's tour.
That's what I know.
As much as I really do genuinely not like Drake, because he's not, I'm just not a fan.
I like him from Degrassi. I have a soft spot.
I think, honestly, Back to Back is one of the better diss tracks I've heard.
It's up there.
It's fire.
It's
like,
up there.
He really took it to him.
Okay, so, like, recent battle or recent beefs, including Drake, everybody in Canada, frankly, this is obvious by now, knows Back to Back. And it's a really great diss song about Meek Mill, as we just discussed. But
totally.
A lot of people don't know the story of A Died On, which is where Drake gets absolutely fucking leveled by Pusha T over Drake's real-life estranged son.
I do know that.
Push alleges that Drake had always neglected, so, like, obviously.
That's right. He was like, where's your kid, Drake?
Yeah. So, then, there's so many more. There's Mace versus Cameron. There's LL Cool J versus Cannabis. Yeah. They actually had a battle within a song that they were both on, which ended up spiraling into a legendary rap beef that basically cost Cannabis his whole career.
Oh, shit.
And if you don't know about Cannabis, like, he would become a figure in organized battle raps later.
I say organized crime and a cool part of the mob.
Yeah. But that's
Cannabis. Might as well.
That actually doesn't matter. I might actually skip over his part. He's such a fucking mark. So then there was Mego versus Joe Budden. Jadakiss versus...
That was sorry. Joe Budden, not Joe Biden.
The president of the United States.
Which is funny because I almost said Jadakiss versus Bernie Sanders, but it's actually Jadakiss versus Beanie Siegel.
Same.
Joe Budden.
And then there's Eminem versus like everybody.
Every person.
Versus
on
every
Earth,
guy
yeah.
that decided to
versus
step up to Eminem.
Personally.
Yeah, Machine Gun Kelly, most recent memory, I guess.
Yeah, those ones I know a little bit about because they're more recent. Those are funny.
Yeah. But, like, of course the granddaddy is Biggie versus Tupac.
Of course.
And while ultimately nobody wins when rap beefs become real-life violence, except maybe Puffy.
I think we all lose in the Tupac versus Biggie beef.
I should say. While my opinion is that Biggie is the better and more important rapper of the two, don't at me. I feel very strongly about
that. I'm with you. Party and Bullshit is a great song, and also there's a
That's
mix.
A good one.
There's a mix with Party in the USA and Party and Bullshit, and it's, Sensation. Give her a listen.
But
I prefer Tupac, but that's fine.
Even with that said, Tupac gets the win for me in the beef track category between the two of them because Hit 'Em Up is my favorite.
Yeah,
oh,
Hit 'Em
Up. That is,
yeah,
that is
okay,
my
know,
favorite diss track ever.
I'm
including Ice Cube and everybody.
Right now, if anyone listening to this has not heard Tupac's Hit 'Em Up,
check it out.
Pause us right the fuck now and listen to Hit 'Em Up and understand how a diss track gets done.
And also, like, learn where I learned the term mark-ass bitches, which is from Tupac.
This yeah. is so... I say mark-ass bitch, which is so humiliating, and is, again, the most Caucasian.
Don't be humiliated. Just own it. So, anyways, basically, you guys, what I'm trying to say is that all of rap is battle rap. It's just a matter of to what degree it is battle rap.
And that's whom they are battle rapping at.
It's turtles all the way down, dude. They're just like some examples of the battles within recorded music that we just gotten into. The old tradition of a circle of MCs in a rap cipher, however, in like a park or just outside of a bar, spitting raps at one another, that can and occasionally does turn into a battle between rappers or even whole crews, trading, you know, barbs of disrespect at one another. And it's an even more direct form of the vicious and, like, frankly, eternal competition that exists within the artistic tradition of rap music.
Totally.
It goes back to the beginning. It goes on today. I've actually probably battled like a dozen guys myself in my life, and I'm not even a very good rapper. There are, like, plenty of stories to tell, but there's one direct battle story that I cannot go forward without telling. Have you guys ever heard of Super Nat or Craig G? In the 80s and 90s, there was this annual music conference in New York City called the New Music Seminar,
cool.
where artists from all over the world would come and play, and it hosted a lot of rap talent over the years. Specifically in 94, there was this rap showcase called Lyricists Lounge that took place regularly in the city for years before that, and they had the stage that night at the New Music Seminar. Craig G was from Juice Crew, who we remember from before from the
yeah.
Roxanne battles. And,
heard of him.
And he was from Queensbridge. He was signed to Atlantic Records. He had two albums
oh,
to
cool.
date. He was a notable artist. And apparently, his attention had been caught by this kid called Supernatural, who will from now on, again, be referred to as Supernat, because that's what you fucking call him. So Supernat wasn't from the Bronx. He wasn't even from New York. This kid came from Indiana to make
oh,
a name
damn.
For himself because he had this preternatural ability, or you might even say a supernatural ability, to just rhyme off the top of his head.
That's cool.
In a way that, like, dudes haven't really been able to freestyle better than him before or since.
Really?
When you saw Eminem Jordan on the bus in 8 Mile.
Hello, I did see that.
When he was on the bus, he's writing down his thoughts on those little scraps
yeah,
of paper.
Yeah, vomit on her sweater already, mom's spaghetti.
Mom's spaghetti,
iconic
yeah.
line.
When Eminem was on the bus in 8 Mile writing down thoughts on those little scraps of paper, he was preparing for battles by writing and memorizing material. For Supernat, he didn't have to. He could just tap into what he needed to. His mind.
So cool.
Yeah, he was neat. His mind was nimble enough that he could just think of something cool to say. Like, it would come out as rhymes because he was always practicing rhyming. That I am familiar with. But being able to bring to bear as vocalization, like, anything you wanted about anything you wanted at any time, that's something very few people have been able to do.
I was
going to
say, that's like a real skill. That's like being having perfect pitch or something like that. Like, that's something incredible.
It's, yeah, it, like, idea from Idea and Abilities was the best that I ever saw do it live.
Idea was incredible.
Incredible. Incredible. May he rest in peace. King Los, Big L, may he also rest in peace. Harry Mack, you know, it's not that long of a list. So, I guess around...
There's not actually, like, as many great rappers as there are. There really aren't a ton that are great at doing this.
There's a lot of not famous rappers that are great at doing it.
I'm sure, yeah, yeah. I'm sure there's a bunch of kids in a park somewhere that are doing it now that are incredible.
Yeah. So, it's, like, I guess around New York City, Supernat wanted a shot at Craig G to make a name for himself because he moved all the way from Indiana to do so. So
Craig G is just the softest rap name.
Craig G was hard.
Bad, but just...
So he started, like...
I'm Craig.
Supernat started talking a lot of shit about Craig in a battle.
He was rhyming with a bunch
Craig,
of stuff.
Craig was both parents have a real good marriage.
That was funny.
Yeah, that's just very, 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 very Clarence-y.
Yeah.
Very Papa Doc.
Papa Doc, fuck the clock.
So Supernat was, like, talking shit about Craig G all over town. And in kind, Craig G didn't like some fucking cornhusker from Indiana talking shit about him in his own town.
Yeah,
so,
talk to me, Midwesterner.
Yeah, so
oh, for sure, bud.
Yeah. So,
oh, you're lame. You're a poser. You know that, right, bud?
Hey, take it easy there, eh? Why don't you just enjoy some cheese like the rest of us? So...
Stop rapping, bud.
So eventually, Craig G is like, yeah, I'll battle this punk. He's tired of his name getting dragged.
Can I say I love the word punk? It's every time I hear it, I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
I love punk as an insult.
It's so good.
So Supernat hears that Craig G has been talking shit back. Yeah. And they both happen to be at this show that I mentioned earlier in the new music seminar on Lyricist Lounge Night. So these guys get on the stage. And the energy is bananas electric.
Awesome.
It's crazy. I mean, I think that after this, we should watch the video.
Okay, yeah.
I'd like to.
There's thousands of people there. Cool. Like, this was an international event.
And what year is this?
94. And they get called on stage. Supernat opens, and he tells Craig G that he's skinny and he must be smoking crack, and everything rhymes. And he's referencing the fact that Craig G hasn't been hot for 3 years since his last record that included the song Dropping Science. His shit is awesome. And then Craig G comes back and he tells him to take his recently jailed heavyweight champ and fellow Midwesterner Mike Tyson and go back to Indiana, which is where Tyson's from. And the crowd goes ape shit. And apparently if you aren't in the first five rows and the video checks out, you can't hear a thing.
Of course.
But the energy is so crazy that everybody in the room is just screaming. Now you can hear the battle when you watch the video, and it's a great battle from start to finish. But Craig G has home field advantage because he's from New York and Supernat is not. And eventually, the whole crowd just drowns out Supernat while he's trying to rap and does chorus chanting. The whole crowd just going, go Craig, go Craig, while Craig is just like styling on him and like doing his thing. And like Supernat can't do shit. Now, some people say the appearance of losing this battle ended Supernat's mainstream career for all intents and purposes on this day. While Craig G is still making records, it would be like a major stretch to say that he's been anywhere close to relevant since the early 90s.
Sure.
Supernat hasn't made a record in 16 or 17 years, but he kept freestyling, he kept battling, he kept, like, you know, bringing himself through the battle scene.
Yeah.
At Rock the Bells in August of 2006, he set the world record for longest continuous freestyle, where he rapped for 9 hours and 55 minutes straight.
That's so
off the
long.
Top of his head. That means, Jordan, what that means is that he didn't have any of that shit written down. He just kept thinking about it on the fly.
That's crazy.
So, we all know that rap is all battle rap. All rap is battle rap.
Totally.
We know the rapping has been fueled by the spirit of competition since day one. We know that people come in with really creative ways to say really mean things to each other. There's only one thing left to do in this culture, and in the 90s and going forward, that's to standardize that shit in the form of dedicated battle rap competitions and full-on continuous leagues.
Cool.
And there are tons of them. Now, before I go on, everything I could possibly say about how racist, sexist, ableist, homophobic, and generally culturally hostile battle rap is, and it is. This has been covered, and I don't have the time to get into it here.
Sure, that's not what this is about. Yeah.
It is. It's so much. And I'm not going to get into it. Eminem produced a film called Bodied a couple years ago, which is written by a really...
Our friend Caleb was in that.
Yeah.
Dope.
Wild.
One of our, actually, the friend that we went to...
Like IRL friends,
He was the star of it. We
that redhead kid. No, that's our pal.
No kidding, eh?
We did musical theater with that kid growing up.
Oh, yeah. Crazy. That's a wild overlap.
So,
that's hilarious.
It was written by this nerdy battle rap Canadian kid named Kid Twist. And like, it's a sort of even-handed look politically on the culture, but it's also, like, a lot of boys will be boys.
Sure.
And that look at that culture, like, if you want to know about how fucked up battle rap is, watch that film. And remember that you're watching it through the perspective of one of its greatest fans and innovators. Like, I can only imagine what a film about battle rap would look like if an actual intersectional feminist got a hold of it. Like, if Arundhati Roy made that movie or some shit. Like, these are very fair and very real grievances with what is incredibly problematic as a subculture. But I love rap too much. So when I listen to it, I just turn my critical thinking skills off and enjoy it, which is... literally what privilege is, if you needed an analogy.
No, but that's why with any movie I ever watched, I was like, it was nice. Like, I just don't, I just like to take in media.
You gotta turn off your brain every once in a while.
Nice. Well, yeah, this one, if you care about anybody, really requires it. Anyway, so Battle Rap Leagues. So in the 1990s, what do you guys know about Battle Rap Leagues? I'll answer your question for you. You don't know anything, and Colby, you know more.
You're right.
In the 1990s, these more formalized battle rap nights, kind of usually hosted at nightclubs, they started springing up first in New York and then across America, and then by about 2000 in Canada and the UK. Eminem famously cut his teeth at Scribble Jam in 1997, Scribble. Right around the time that he released his first album, Infinite. And his battle versus Juice at Scribble Jam is pretty legendary in that world, as is Juice's battle against our old pal Supernat.
Those ones I actually know.
Since Eminem met Dr. Dre and signed to Aftermath shortly thereafter, it imbued the young battle rap scene with a lot more legitimacy than it probably would have enjoyed otherwise. This, of course, greatly multiplied with the success of 8 Mile, and all of a sudden, there were battle leagues just popping up everywhere.
Yeah, Freddie Murphy was so successful in that film, they thought we all want to be like her.
I mean, I want to live, but whatever.
No, Tyler, no! Please! I love her so much! You can't do this to me!
excellent joke. Carry on.
So, like, for example, I got my ass fucking served to me on a silver platter at a battle at the Boom Boom Room.
She's
a deep cut.
By this really good rapper named Paiute in 2003. So, even in our little corner of the continent, this was really happening. There were 8 rappers that night, bracket format. I won my first battle, I have no idea how, and then I lost to the eventual winner in the second round.
This is like fully like UFC 1.
Yeah, totally UFC 1.
I think the grand prize for this was $100.
So exactly like UFC 1.
Almost exactly, yeah.
There are dudes rapping at big events now for millions per appearance.
Yeah, that's awesome.
There are the DMCs, World Rap Championships, 106 in Park, which is still on actual cable TV today. But not every rapper could afford to travel, and soon every state in the lower 48 and most of the Canadian provinces had these regional leagues.
Cute.
And some of them grew into legitimate media companies. It's kind of hard to find good writing about a lot of the early days of battle rap, but I remember watching YouTube videos of Grind Time Now, which started in California in 2006 and eventually opened up chapters in the South and Midwest and East Coast of America. This place was the first home for like many of the biggest names in battle rap still today, even all these years later, like Hollow the Dawn, Fresco, Charlie Clips, T-Rex, DNA, Aver, Byron Solomon, Arsenal, Dumbfounded, Disaster. Like, these guys are stars still.
10 out of 10, incredible names, everybody.
Yeah.
Every one of those is a great rap.
A lot of these guys are pushing 40, and they've been doing this since they were kids. And while Grind Time was short-lived as a company, as far as I can tell, that this was due to drugs and some discrepancies about how to do business. It served as a really good template model for how to monetize and grow the sport of battle rap, which I think it's kind of fair to call it.
Yeah.
You create a YouTube channel, you hold events, you sell those events as pay-per-views for your diehards, you sell tickets and merch to people who actually come to the show, and then you monetize through YouTube views as you release the individual battles once a week while promoting your next event. Absolutely. Like, rinse, repeat. This is still what everybody does to this day.
I would say this is, like, how YouTube runs for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, and, like, they were one of the first, like, successful non-television-style, like, cartoon-style models to do this. Yeah. Some clever promoters have gotten so rich doing this. And some individual battlers have gotten really rich by creating their own leagues so that they don't just have to battle for fees anymore. They can start making all of this promoter revenue.
Nice.
It turns out that one of the most enduring and largest battle enterprises in the whole world is out of Toronto. And it's called the King of the Dot.
King of the Dot.
King of the Dot. big the fuck up, King of the Dot, big fan. At the same
This is the one I was waiting for.
Yeah. So, at the same time as the other battle promotion, Behemoth Ultimate Rap League started around the same time.
Ultimate Rap League.
It's a URL, baby. which is still the biggest product in the sport to this day, at least in the Western world. And Don't Flop in the UK. King of the Dot was started by Organic and his buddy Avi in 2008. And they did something that the other rap leagues weren't committed to doing since the decline of Grind Time. They actually judged battles and crowned champions.
Oh, cool.
There are, to this day, dudes walking around with King of the Dot diamond chains. And in that culture, that's like having a Super Bowl ring.
Yeah, not to bring it back to drag, as I always do, but they have, like, the drag scenes like that, too. It's like voguing and balls and stuff. They would do similar things where, like, you'd be the queen of this night or whatever. Sounds very similar.
Yeah, well, it's similar, except that it's, like, they only give out, like, 1 or 2 a year.
These were a little more, but and still, like...
And, like, in the world...
Well, these gals were in different cities.
I think we can mix them. I bet there's some drag queens out there that could fucking drop a sick...
There are. Well, the drag queen. I'll show you one.
There's absolutely no doubt about it.
Yeah, I'll show you when we finish. Remind me.
Yeah, I want to see. So, this largely in Canada kind of started as, like, really bad white appropriation culture.
Shocking.
Unsurprising.
Us in Canada doing that.
But the roster of talent over the years has grown a lot more diverse and it's getting a lot better. But Kid Twist, who we mentioned before, who wrote that Bodied movie,
yeah.
He actually was the first King of the Dot. And it actually took KOTV 10 title matches before they crowned their first real person of color.
Wow.
Yeah, well, it's kind of laughable to think of what the American talent pool would have done to them back then.
In the late
aughts and early teens. Mm. But things are a lot more diverse now, and now most of the King of Dot champions are Americans, actually. And really? A lot of Canadians don't like this, but I think it's generally better for the sport because the best talent is competing for really one of the only prizes in rap. Yeah. There's nobody else that's doing this. The other leagues that I'm familiar with decided not to judge battles from day one and continue not to do so to this day. And keep in mind, this is 12 years, like sometimes more.
Yeah.
They just hold events and let the fans decide who won.
That is kind of cool, though. So that way it's not like so official. It's kind of just like you won on this day because the crowd is a
big. I mean, I have mixed feelings about it because it's not really the crowd that decides. It's usually more like endless internet arguments.
Well, as everything is. So, I've said this before.
You shouldn't get to win if you just brought the most people.
Sure, but the social climate is absolutely, it's made online.
Sure. But some of the online disagreements about people who won rap battles have literally spilled over into real life violence.
Unsurprising, people are deeply mad.
It's actually because men are awful.
Shocking.
I won't argue with that.
But, like, I get why the other leagues didn't want to judge battles, and in my opinion, the biggest thing is that it doesn't make much sense for a rapper whose whole job is to say that he is good and you are bad to have an actual paper trail of his failures. Like,
sure.
Plausible deniability is always in play this way. And if your opponent says, the last guy fucking washed you, and that must have been really embarrassing for you, you can literally just smile and say, nah, that's not how me and my fans remember it.
If you step up and you're like, hey man, the last 7 battles you've lost, let's talk about that.
Well, yeah, and dudes like that, because this is capitalism, dudes like that don't get booked anymore.
Of sure, course. Yeah, of course.
Like, you have to be debatably winning all the time.
Yeah.
So, the biggest battles in the Western Hemisphere, I think this is what's going to tweak you guys the most. The biggest battles in the Western Hemisphere are almost always on URL Ultimate Rap League. their stages in New York mostly. And these events are attended by the most famous rappers in the world, from Puffy to Busta, Drake, Kendrick, Eminem.
I know all those people you just said.
Yeah.
That's how you know they're famous.
Yeah, that's how you know. In 2012, Loaded Lux, who is perhaps the most important battle rapper to never make a hit record, he battled this guy named Calico, an up-and-coming guy from Detroit at the time. He's a big star now. Mm-hmm. And this battle has 6.5 million views on YouTube.
Oh, no way.
It's, like, not niche. It's, like, kind of a big deal.
Yeah, that's, like, very...
And yeah. And URL used to promote shows before this at small nightclubs, and now they throw them at small arenas.
Cool.
Like, they get, like, thousands and thousands of people out to these shows now.
That's awesome.
It's rare for a URL main event to not get at least a million views.
Wow.
And King of the Dot, mostly their big events get like 750,000 views, sometimes way more. Sometimes other leagues have caught lightning in a bottle across the water. Ozone and Base Mentality in Sweden have both done really solid numbers and attracted big talent from stateside. Battle Rap is huge in Germany and has like a ton of different leagues. Some of the best and most viewed battle rappers in England are under Don't Flop, and they get all kinds of international talent. It's very popular in France. My favorite non-English language to listen to rap in.
Because everything rhymes.
Yeah. No. That's more Spanish and Italian. French takes a lot more doing.
The love languages.
The Aussies, they have Got Beef, which is decades old promotion.
Got Beef.
Got Beef.
Yeah, Beef.
Had to do an accent. And, this is 10 in a row?
They've produced...
Wait till you get to my episode.
Fuck. They've produced some really good rappers. And... it's also my least favorite non-English language to listen to rap in. There's Punch Out in Hungary, which I bet is full of Nazis. And there's Spit Mexico, which has some crazy chaotic videos I've really enjoyed. There's Bars in Nigeria and Sable in South Africa and Lib in Liberia and B3 in India.
Dang.
Yeah, it's crazy. But the numbers that they do in America and Europe combined absolutely pale in comparison to the absolute batshit obsession that they have for battle rap in Russia.
I love Russia! Okay, I'm so here for this.
It is not uncommon for battles out of the Versus Battle League to do 50 million views.
Wow.
Oxymiron, the undisputed champion of post-Soviet rap, is a linguistics professor and friend of Russian government apparatchiks, the hockey stars and oil barons. He had a battle to his name with 112 million views on YouTube before somebody involved in the promotion mysteriously took it down a few years ago, and I literally could not find out why, and I'm pretty good at the internet. He's like Tay Swift famous over there.
So this dude's like, he's homies with Ovechkin and Habib and every Russian star.
I haven't seen any pictures of him with Ovechkin and Habib, but he's with some dudes.
And I haven't seen any pictures with Batman and Bruce Wayne, but yet here we are.
That's a very good point. So he did this performance over in Los Angeles against Disaster, who's like one of the true legends of the sport.
Does he have like the thickest Russian accent?
He does. And Oxy did...
Is he really hot?
No. And Oxy did the battle entirely in English, which is his fourth language. All of his battles are in Russian.
Okay, so he sounds...
Such a classic fucking European approach to things.
But he sounds hot.
Most Russian battle fans do not speak English, and this battle is the most watched battle in King of the Dot history with nearly 15 million views.
Even though his
fan base, which draws all the views, can't understand what he's saying.
Holy shit.
They just wanted to watch him fucking battle.
Yeah, I've seen that battle like two or three times. He was awesome in it. And then, it gets even better. It's just like we all predicted. Then there's the Philippines. So while the YouTube Heights...
I was wondering what they were doing through it all.
Yeah. So...
been quiet up till now.
The highest of high like video counts for Russian and Filipino battles are like pretty similar. All the biggest Russian battles have Oxymiron featured as a contestant. There's only about 10 of them with really gaudy numbers. The Philippines battle rap scene, mostly through the Flip Top and Sunugan promotions, boast hundreds of videos with more than 15 million views, and from a way larger pool of artists from anywhere other than the United States. Filipino battle rapper Looney is one of my favorites, and next to Oxy, he's probably the most viewed battle rapper in the world. So,
wow.
Looney is a great name also. Not to get bogged down in names.
So yeah, organized battle rap is mean and super problematic culturally in so many ways, but it got promoted similarly to how boxing and MMA do. Because at its essence, it's basically verbal blood sport.
Sure, yeah.
People want to see new and interesting ways for people to make themselves sound cool and tough and say awful things to their opponents. And more than that, if you can look past the unmitigated aggression and toxic masculinity, it's actually a really pure art form. Rap has been around for 50 years now, and people have gotten really, really good at the things I just described. Outside of our beloved musical artists who we hear on the radio and on, you know, Spotify or whatever all the time, there's this culture that is still largely underground, being done largely by kids on the bleachers after the sun goes down, where the whole point of the exercise is to say something in a way that nobody has ever said it before. And you can take it from me, that's no easy task. I'd like to finish with this. MC Shan said, they used to do it out in the park. Hip-hop was set out in the dark. And the spirit of competition fuels hit records, public beefs, songs written about songs, a really problematic and fundamentally nerdy culture about two people yelling at each other on a stage about how they themselves are strong and cool, and their opponent is weak and lame. And weak and lame people sometimes get shot by people who are strong and cool. And they do it in front of thousands of people in stadiums and millions of people in their homes and all across our ever-warming earth. But they also do it outside of the bar, or in the park, or with their friends. And sometimes when they're just doing it with their friends, it's the dopest shit I've ever heard. So that's my episode.
Thank you for doing that with
us. Sensational.
If I may ask you something, as someone who is a big fan of battle rap, we're going to go on a scale of, I'm going to say, the baseline is Kendrick. So Kendrick is a 0, and the 10 is, what's the wackest rapper you can think of?
You did an episode on ICP.
Okay, so on a scale of Kendrick to ICP, where is the YouTube channel Epic Rap Battles of History?
Oh, that's like, so 10 is the wackest?
10, like ICP is a 10, they're the wackest you can be, so like they could be an 11 or 12.
It's funny, I actually, in my notes when I started writing this episode, I was like, don't forget to shit on Epic Rap Battles of History.
I was waiting for you to do it, and you haven't yet, so this is the opportunity I'm presenting you.
That is
terrible.
That is the wackest shit of all time.
Have you guys read Lord of the Flies?
Yes.
No.
You never? Not even high school?
Really?
No.
Are you familiar with the story of Lord of the Flies?
Oh, I thought you were talking about The Fly with Jeff Goldblum. I actually have read Lord of the Flies. Piggy in the Conch and sucks to your ass more, yeah.
Yes, I assumed we all have.
Just an aside, isn't Jeff Goldblum so handsome?
He's a dreamboat.
Oh, completely.
So, for anyone who has not read Lord of the Flies or is currently confusing it with The Fly with Jeff Goldblum...
or is in the 10th grade and hasn't read it yet.
Lord of the Flies is a disturbing novel.
And my act.
It imagines what would happen if a group of young boys were stranded on an island. What starts off as a joyous celebration of a life without parents or rules quickly devolves into savagery. Do you think that would really happen?
I don't think what happened to the group of girls.
I think it would totally depend on the composition of the people that were there.
If a group of young school-age boys were stranded on an island.
Oh, right. They're school-age boys. Yeah, that would probably happen.
How old are they in the book? Like 13?
In the book they're actually a little bit younger.
Oh, are they?
I think they're around the ages of like 9 to 13.
Oh, damn. I think from my experience of, I used to babysit a lot, as I've told you before, my experience of young boys that age is that they're very dumb and very violent, but they don't, not in a malicious way, just in an exploring way. So I do think that some dumb shit would definitely happen.
I also think that it's really common for kids to click up.
A hierarchy kind of naturally forms.
Yeah. I believe they call it a pecking order, but in this case, it's a rock to the head order.
Well, in 1966, a fisherman by the name of Peter Warner had been sailing through Tonga when he and his small crew anchored down for the night off of the uninhabited island of Ada. I say uninhabited. It had been inhabited until 1863 when a slave ship rolled up, and unfortunately that was kind of it for the people of Ada.
Wow.
And so no one had been on the island for 100 years at this point, so one of the ship's crew said that he swore he heard a human voice calling out. It was dismissed as a bird.
Sure. You're being a dumb baby.
They're just like,
you've never been on an island before. They're birds. They sound scary.
Yes. All right, mate. Like,
Also, there are those Australian birds that can, like, sound like the chainsaws or whatever.
Yeah.
David Attenborough.
Birds are terrifying. We've talked about it before. I hate them.
I was just
Colby is one.
They're a menace. He is one. He's a crow.
Australians call women birds.
Hey, are you about to do an accent?
Oh man, there's a lot already kind of built up in this episode.
I advise you to not.
All right, I disagree.
All right, fine. We'll skip over my whole bit with the accent. But the whole idea is one of the people on the boat was sure that he heard a human voice calling out to them.
Yeah.
And the captain, Peter Warner, was like, no, like, there's nobody on these islands. Do you know what Tonga is?
No.
It's in the South Pacific.
Guy from Tonga actually stole my first girlfriend in grade 8. No, not kidding.
Call him out. Say his name.
Nick something.
Nick from Tonga.
Nick, fuck you.
So Tonga is a kingdom in the South Pacific. Okay. It's like 170 islands.
Cool.
And it's a kind of an archipelago.
Okay.
And so there's a ton of islands that are not inhabited and tons that are.
Is it archipelago as I say it?
Archipelago?
I think I've said archipelago out loud before.
Never again.
No, I won't.
They're out there fishing and they anchor down off of this island. And one of the crewmen's like, no, like, I hear people calling. There's something going on. And the captain's like, no, man, like, you hear birds.
Like, stopping a baby.
Yeah, shut up. And they look closer at this island of Ada and they see smoke.
So, like, birds don't do that generally.
And especially, like, at the time, I think it was October. And they're like, no, like, forest fires don't happen out there, especially not on an island that's uninhabited. And they look closer and they go, oh, no. There are people on that island.
Hell yeah.
And not only are there people on that island, but one of them had jumped into the ocean and was swimming frantically towards their boat.
No way.
Huh. So they help this naked young man onto this ship where he introduces himself and he says, "Is my name Steven?" Seriously, like, they actually have, like, kind of an Australian accent. Like, I'm doing it pretty honestly.
Fine, go ahead.
But he goes, "My name's Steven. There are six of us. And I reckon we've been here for 15 months.
Holy shit.
The rest of the boys soon followed into the water, and Peter and his crew couldn't believe what they were seeing or hearing. 15 months is a long time to be stranded on an island.
No kidding.
And while these boys had the long hair of only the shipwrecked or hippies, they were healthy and honestly downright muscular. They were in good shape. Sure enough, 15 months earlier, these six boys, Stephen, Colo, David, Sion, Luke, and Mano, were stranded, and as far as they knew, forgotten, left for over a year to fend for themselves on the deserted island of Ada.
How did they get there?
I imagine we're going to find out. That's fucking crazy, bro. Okay, so, just imagine, like, I know we're going to get to this stuff.
Oh, we are.
But just imagine being one of those dumb kids.
No.
One of those dumb sailors. And I come from sailor people. We are dumb. Just like getting stranded on an island and then seeing the ship that you thought would never come.
Yeah.
Like, you must just imagine, like, after, like, 8 months of that, it's like, well, I guess I gotta fuck Colo.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, I would never make it that long. After day, like, 5 to 6, I would simply pass away. Like, I just...
Oh, yeah, we're gonna get there.
No, you'd be fucking Colo for sustenance.
Colo sounds hot, honestly. No, but I know myself well enough to know that I don't like carrying things that are heavy. I need glasses to see. I'm like, I thrive best when I have something to complain about. So maybe I would do kind of
well. Oh, I think you would do amazing.
But then after a while, when they were like, hey, can you build a hut? I'd be like, nah. And I would Sylvia Plath that shit, walk into the sea with some stones, out.
No, that was Naomi Wolf.
Oh, Naomi Wolf, that's right. See, I'm Sylvia Plath's head in the oven.
Yeah, no, there's no oven for you.
Sorry.
No, there's only stones. There are only actually coconuts, probably, the way I'm picturing it.
Right into the ocean.
So. Up until a year earlier, a year and a bit, I'm going to say, these boys had been students at a Catholic boarding school in the Tongan capital of Nuku'alofa.
Oh, wait, so how old are these boys, man?
Nuku'alofa.
They were between the ages of 13 and 16.
Oh, sorry, I said Cuomo sounds hot. I changed my mind.
You love him.
they kind
but of... you're also 13 to 16 in this.
That's true. In this Who knows? In this story, I could be. Maybe I'm
It's 1966, so no.
I was busy being not born. My mom wasn't even born yet. Yeah.
So these boys, these six boys, between the ages of 13 and 16, they're at this strict Catholic boarding school, and collectively they were like, fuck school.
Hell yeah.
You know, like...
Tell them.
How boys are.
Yeah.
How people in school are. And so they come up with a plan. A terrible, misguided plan to run away.
Talk to me.
They were going to sail to Fiji.
Sure.
So... Geography is not my strong suit. I know it's not yours, Jordan. Tyler, no. You're pretty good at geography.
You seem smart.
Ish, but the South Pacific is brutal.
Fiji is 500 miles away from Nuku'alofa.
Pretty far, all things See, considered.
I wouldn't have known that, but I know that it just basically goes out way farther than you thought it would.
Yeah, so it's a trip that in optimal conditions with an experienced crew. Mm-hmm. 4 days minimum of straight sailing.
Damn.
This wasn't an experienced crew. These were six boys who didn't even have a boat.
Yeah.
They didn't even have a boat, and they were going to fucking sail to Fiji, and they were like, you know what? Doesn't matter, because there is
They're like, we're really confident we'll make it work.
They are like, you know what? There's a fisherman in town that we don't care for.
Steal his
so
shit.
So we will borrow one of his boats.
Hell yeah. I'm here for this. Now that they're stealing, I'm like, yes, I like it.
So with a plan in place...
I'm just like, Klepto, cut this out, I love stealing.
So with a plan no, in place, is. And the confidence that can only come from being a teenager,
of course.
The boys gathered their humble supplies.
You must have had different teenagers than me, I just want to say.
They were like, you know what, a map? Get the fuck out of here.
We don't need it.
Where we're going, we don't need maps.
Fuck a map.
They're like, a compass? Nah, never Forget heard of her. It. Never heard of her.
It doesn't matter, we have the stars.
They brought two sacks of bananas.
Of course.
A small gas burner, and a few coconuts.
That's all you need.
Holy guacamole.
They're set up for life.
What these boys managed to accomplish on Ada is nothing short of incredible. But it's even more so when you consider how dumb every decision they made that got them here was.
Yeah, of course. Kids are famously stupid.
It was a calm summer evening, and no one saw the boys head to the pier and take the boat. And just like that, they were off. The first evening was literal smooth sailing for the runaways. Their very first night at sea, they managed to all fall asleep.
Sleepy kings, I love it.
They were awoken by winds that tore apart their sails and destroyed their rudder. Leaving them completely powerless and adrift in the Pacific.
Jeez.
So they got wind blown to an island they could live on in the South Pacific.
Day one of their adventure.
The boys drifted for 8 days.
Unbelievable.
They collected rainwater and the coconut shells, each taking a sip in the morning and one in the evening.
Okay, well that's smart at least.
Attempts at catching fish and seabirds from the boat were fruitless, and things were looking very dire for these six young men until they saw the island of Ada.
Hell yeah.
Something you have to understand is Ada is not white sand beaches and coconut trees. It is not heaven. It is not what you would expect when you think of a tropical island.
I'm thinking very Pirates of the Caribbean vibes.
Like rocky?
So Ada...
It looks nice. It looks green at least. That wouldn't make me feel too nervous. Pretty rocky though.
Oh, like deep cliffs.
Yeah. No, that would feel safe to me. I think with the greens, I'd be okay, at least
that's
only water
here. That's only because you've seen Jurassic Park.
It's true. Yeah. And I love Jeff Goldblum. And Laura Dern.
Gosh, who doesn't?
What I'm trying to say is, like, Ada was not paradise. It was a rocky oak cropping that shot 1,000 feet out of the sea.
Oh, no.
It was raw cliff face. But if you've been out at sea for 8 days...
It looks like
anything,
yeah, we should go
anything
there.
Is heaven.
Totally.
I believe they say any port in the storm.
They crash their boat into Ada, and for 3 months the boys found shelter in an alcove at the base of the island.
Such a long time.
That's dope.
So long.
To describe Ada, like it literally shot out of the sea. It's 1,000 feet almost straight up, almost entirely rock cliff face, and the ocean had kind of carved away at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And they took shelter under there.
I can't wait to be the kid that dies trying to climb it first. That's my role. I know my role. That's it.
And so they tucked under this giant island into these alcoves. And they for 100 fucking days, they're under there.
That's so
long. Waiting. They said the entire time they were wondering, you know, when a rogue wave would crash over the island and take them away and drown them.
Jesus,
they survived by catching seagulls.
Whoa.
Eating their flesh.
How did they catch them?
With their hands. They ate their flesh raw.
Ew, oh no.
And they drank their blood because they didn't have fresh water.
No.
For 100 days, they stayed in this alcove.
Without fresh water?
Catching birds with their hands.
Just iron heavy blood.
I thought you died after like 5 days of water.
No,
but they're drinking their blood.
Blood's not salty.
They were taking these birds, catching with their hands, eating their raw flesh, and drinking their blood.
I do understand the blood part, but I mean, can you...
That is the sickest shit I've ever heard, and is the theme for my new horror rap record.
I thought you needed fresh water to, like, live,
You
though.
Just need hydration.
Wild!
Mm-hmm. He was saying they found, like, waterlogged driftwood,
okay.
And they'd, like, wring it out and, like, try and drink from the wood. In addition to drinking blood.
So, wow. I mean, that's like a testament to the human spirit that like, they want to live.
Yes. It is survival spirit.
Yeah.
More like Lord of the Guys.
Hey, I also don't think I've ever wanted to, I don't think I want to live that bad. Like, that sounds tragic, but like, no. Let me go at that point.
Yeah, I'm trying to climb that hill. Yeah. See what happens.
You be climbing, I'll come with you.
Yeah.
After nearly 100 days on the island, they finally found a path that they believed could lead them safely to the top of Ada, away from the rocks and the waves.
Right.
Fueled only by raw seagull meat and willpower.
Blood.
It took them 2 days to scale the mountain.
God, that's so long. These poor boys.
They reached the top of the mountain, and they found what might as well have been Shangri-La.
Bird eggs.
If you recall earlier, I mentioned there used to be people living on Ada.
Yeah.
And this is where they had been, at the top of those brutal cliffs, in a beautiful and bountiful forest.
No doubt.
Hell yeah.
When 100 years previous, the slavers took the people of Ada, things were left behind.
That's crazy. Go on.
Just drinking seagull blood and then you're like, for fuck's sakes.
A couple of
Sorry, can we just go back? How long did they drink seagull blood for?
100 days.
3 months.
That's...
too long.
Bonkers.
Because they could not find a way to the top
of the mountain. And they were malnourished, so they couldn't use their brains to figure out that this was not the move.
And they were apparently trying the entire time to get to the top because they saw trees and they saw like at the top of this mountain
there has to be fresh water, like, things are growing up.
There has to be plants. There has to be things we can get to.
Oh my god!
And they tried like that entire 100 day period. They were trying to find ways to the top, but like they were weak and they just couldn't find the right way up.
Poor babies.
So they were literally drinking bird blood and eating their raw meat, trying to gather the strength to find a way up to the top.
Thank you.
So eventually they get up there and they find what used to be, it was what was left over from the people that were in Ada 100 years previous. They found some leftover knives. They found some tools.
Hell yeah.
They found coconut and pineapple trees.
Yum.
They found bean and banana plantations. And most importantly, they found chickens.
Fuck yeah. Oh my god, that must have been like heaven on earth after a 3 months of blood.
With no humans left to cull their population, the chickens that belonged to the people of Ada had been breeding and roaming freely for over a century, the fruit that was there had kind of been just doing its own thing.
Free range chickens.
So they came up and they found this forest that had hundreds of chickens and coconut trees and pineapple trees and a banana plantation and beans. And they found literal heaven on the top of this island because they finally got there.
Can I say real quick that America has found heaven and they have decided to fuck it up by making an embargo against Cuba so they can't have cheap pineapples? Just saying.
Pineapples are the best. So
natural source of bromelain, which makes you happy.
We need more pineapples on this pod.
So the boys get up there and I really like this quote. When they got there, he said it was like the spirit of the old people watching over them.
That's nice.
Like, they got there and it was like, all of them are like, you know what? Like, people have lived here before.
Yeah.
people can live here again.
Totally.
How could you help feel that way when you were certain that you were going to die,
drinking
bird blood
and raw bird flesh,
and then rolling up a mountain, and everybody gets up, and then all of a sudden it's just full of game birds and fruit,
and that's what it was. They're like, okay, something
honestly not great for keto. It's still pretty good. Just eat the chickens.
It was very much like, hey, something is obviously looking out for us here.
Totally. This feels like a sign.
And it's like, that kind of like revitalized them. They're like, okay, you know what? Like,
oh my God, we can do this. Is that how literally every religion started?
Totally.
So with their bellies full of fruit and their strength returning, the boys began to work.
Sugar bursting through their veins.
Turning the top of the island into a bona fide camp. It took 4 days of work, but they got a fire burning.
Nice.
And it was like very much the old school, like rubbing sticks together, tossing shit at it until something burned.
Totally.
It took them 4 days of work to get that fire burning. But from the 100 days since, like from the start, from the point they got it started to the point where they got rescued, that fire did not go out once.
Oh, I can't imagine it.
They tended to it day in and day out.
Well, they had the memory of no fire.
Totally.
They were like, hey man, raw bird flesh kind of sucks.
Yeah, we're going to get listeria and die.
Cooked bird flesh is pretty
delicious.
Cool.
Delicious.
And also, let's remember how cold we were on windy nights. And also, like, let's remember the most important thing, which is that we sucked and now we're awesome.
We made it.
It took another 4 days of labor, but a tree trunk was carved into a basin to collect fresh rainwater.
So these boys seem smart. I wouldn't even think to do that.
So
you would. The rain would fall from the sky, and you would remember that you had not had any fresh water.
Sure, sure.
An additional 2 weeks were spent weaving palm fronds. One of the young men learned when he was younger and still remembered the technique, allowing them to build a hut large enough for all six to sleep in.
They made a hut?
Get out of Dodge.
You and I could never make a hut.
I would make you make a hut with me.
Alright.
They made a schedule for themselves.
You'd probably do like 27% of the work.
Yeah, you know that I have limits.
They worked in teams of two, hunting, cooking, and standing guard.
Tiny utopia.
To a point where when they got in arguments with each other, and that would happen, of course, they imposed timeouts.
No, they self-police.
When they got in arguments, someone who was angry.
What year was this?
1965.
There was no way there were timeouts back then.
Sweet boys.
One of them just walked away. When they would get angry with each
other, parents they just punched me in the head every time I was mad. There was no way they were taught timeouts.
Yeah,
this is not true, Mom. I love you.
So when they were in arguments with each other, they would just leave.
That's nice.
Like, you know what? I need a little bit of time apart.
Yeah, we need a breather.
Mm-hmm. This is the opposite of Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, why don't we go to this island?
And also pretty much the same story as Lord of the Rings.
And while the camp at the top of the island certainly made living on Ada easier, surviving there was anything but. It was a task made all the more difficult when Stephen lost his footing on a hunting expedition, tumbling 40 feet down the mountain and snapping his leg.
No, Stephen! No, what happened to him?
Well, I'm telling you the story.
Tell him faster!
We're worried about Stephen.
Is he okay?
The others helped him back up to camp, where they splinted his leg and pulled extra duty until Stephen was up and walking again.
Oh, damn, they healed him!
When they did eventually see a doctor back home, the doctors were like, this is perfect.
Whoa!
When these boys got back home, they were not only, like, the doctors were not only blown away by the fact that, like, his leg is perfectly healed. Like,
were they also blown away by the fact that all of the boys who got stranded didn't die?
Obviously, yes, but they were...
They were very excited about the leg. And he didn't have, like, any infections or anything. He was just cool.
These kids put on weight.
They ate too much chicken.
No, well, there was nowhere for them to run. How big is this mountain?
No, they were muscular when they came back, but they came back in good shape.
Well, yeah, if you're making huts and eating chicken and vegetables, it's kind of it, isn't it?
That was kind of thing. Like when they got onto this boat, when they got on this boat, it was like they're muscular.
You're hot as hell. What's going on?
They're shredded. They're hanging dong.
Just so jacked.
Yeah, and they're like, you cannot be. There's no even start for 15 months.
Yeah, we don't believe you.
Every one of them came home looking like Tyrese. Just like, unreal.
Their parents are like, that's not our kid.
So,
and then he just like describes a bunch of memories and like, wow, Tyrese, I guess you are my kid.
So, around the time that Steven had fallen and broken his leg and had it healed, the group in general were like, you know what? We can't do this. Like, we're going to get off of this island, we need to be proactive.
Sure.
So they built a raft.
Know how to build a raft? I don't know how to build a raft.
I mean, like,
well, they didn't again, either.
It's like the water thing. Like, you would just be like, "Hey, can we strap a shitload of trees together and like use the like the branches as like rope?"
Sure, I guess.
And that's kind of thing is like, I don't know what their plan was with the raft because it took them 8 days of drifting at sea to get to this island. Yeah. I don't know if they wanted 8 days for back.
Even more probably.
They built a raft and it almost immediately was torn apart.
Winds that were crazy, right?
Yeah, it was like they did like one test drive with the raft and it got dashed across the rocks and they're like, holy fuck. Like,
actually though, kudos for doing a test drive.
Yes, smart. Because I would never.
You would.
No, I think you're underestimating how dumb I am.
Oh, they're like 6 months on the island at this point. Like, it's been a while. Someone's broken their leg. Like,
they know things are dangerous.
And kind of the thing at this point, once that raft broke, they were like, we might be here forever. Yeah. Like, if we tried to be proactive, we tried to get off of this island.
It seems like it's not happening.
And that
for
didn't
us.
Happen. And I think people have forgotten about us. So this kind of might be it for us. Like, we might live on this island forever. So like, we need to make this
and
as good as it
so
can be.
And I'm so tired of fucking Colo.
Colo! Famously 13 years old.
So, they well and truly may be stranded here. Unbeknownst to them, funerals have been held back home. Like,
oh, because, yeah, that makes sense. If you're gone for 15 months, it's like, probably not coming back.
A ship was missing and these six boys were gone, never to be seen again. Like, funerals were held. They were gone.
Rip.
The six young men started towards rehabilitating the island. While life on Otto was never easy, it did get more comfortable. They replanted bean vines and tended to the banana plantations, and one of the boys, Colo, made a ukulele out of a coconut shell, some driftwood.
He was hot.
And wires he salvaged from the original ship.
Holy guacamole.
We love him.
That is my fella.
He led them in song and prayer, and in the evenings, they would chase the now wild chickens around the camp for sport and snack.
Precious.
They would chase the chickens around, but they kind of had it down pat on like how to hunt like the seabirds. And sure. Then at night, it kind of became like a game of like, okay, can we chase these chickens down?
Sure, kids playing.
Yeah, and that's really what it was.
Also, like, if one of us had to get a chicken, it'd be really hard. But if three of us had to get a chicken, chickens are dumb as shit. Yeah. So you could just, like, distract them, and then, you know.
They haven't encountered a human in their lives.
Yes, I don't know, to be
what
scared.
What about eggs?
We're gonna get there.
We're getting
there. Oh, gosh. Recreation kind of became a thing that they worked towards, and the boys built a badminton court, and they helped boxing matches, and they built a makeshift bench press up at the top of Ada.
Precious.
Well, after they started hitting each other, they had to figure out how to hit harder.
I'm going to show you this quote, and I think this is like one of the coolest quotes that I heard during all this. He said, if we got lazy, nature would beat us.
Oh, damn.
They understood, like, as comfortable as they got there, and, like, things were going well for them, they understood that if they, like, kind of let themselves slack, Mother Nature would fucking ruin them. They just spent 100 days at the base of this island drinking bird blood after being 8 days at sea.
Drink every time we say bird blood in this episode.
And like, hey, we're comfortable now and things are going well.
I haven't stopped.
But if we like kind of take a step back and breathe, we'll get our shit wrecked.
Totally. We're still children on an island where there's no supervision and it's insane here.
So the boys eventually built traps, and they began working towards re-domesticating the chicken population on the island. And when they were rescued, they had 200 chickens in pens that they had built.
Jesus!
And they kept them entirely for eggs. They were still going out daily on hunting trips for seabirds, and they kept the chickens for when the storms got bad enough that the seagulls wouldn't land on the island.
Holy.
Like, they had an entire schedule set.
That's awesome.
These kids are so impressive.
So while life on Ada began to develop like a bit of routine for these boys, their thoughts were never far from home. And it was after 15 full months, all four seasons and then some, on this brutal, unforgiving island, that these young men got to go home. When the six climbed aboard Peter Warner's boat, he radioed back to Nuku'alofa, explaining what the boys had told him, and he received a tearful response from the capital.
Aww.
We've had funerals for these boys. Like, if this is who you are saying they are,
this is a miracle. And all of them are okay, yeah.
The young men said one last prayer as they departed. I don't know if it was the prayer they said on the boat, but this was kind of the documentary I watched. They said something along the lines of, like, we feared you had forgotten us, and we were the castaways, but now we are alive.
Cute. Sweet. Oh, their parents must have been so happy.
So can you fucking imagine?
No. Literally, no.
No, no, me neither. Not even a little bit.
Yeah.
So they sailed away from Ada, finally towards home. Word spread quickly amongst the locals, who gathered at the port to welcome the boys back, and they watched as the police boat went to Matt Peters, where the local cops boarded the vessel, arrested all six boys, and promptly threw them in jail.
For stealing the boat?
For stealing the boat.
Hell yeah!
Unbelievable!
So the fishermen that they didn't like...
I'm trying to have a fucking nice time here, you guys.
Sorry. So,
the men they'd sold the boat from literally 15 months before
were like, where the fuck is our boat, dude?
When he found out the boys were alive and coming back, was livid with the fact that his boat had gone missing.
Like, I thought they were dead.
And demanded to press charges.
What a weenie! Did he get beat up by everybody?
No, they got arrested. They got thrown in jail before they got fucking back to their own.
He should have got a beat up.
Man.
They were like, you guys are all too handsome and healthy. You're going to jail.
So.
What a fucking sexy jail.
This could be an entire fucking other story. Some deals were swung. Some like media deals were sold. And this guy was, like, given a little bit of money for the boat that was taken a year and a half previous.
Here's $5, get out of our face.
And the boys were released from jail.
Yes!
Home at last, and free. The island celebrated for literal days. Like, I've seen the video. It was literal days and days and days. Like, proper celebration.
I can imagine.
It was feasting and singing and dancing. There was song and just... everyone was there to welcome these boys back. They were so communal.
Yeah.
Welcome them back to their home. And they were, as the interview they were talking about, they're like, a couple of us had girlfriends. Like, we're not sure if they remember us. Like, our families are different now. They came back. They had, like, their siblings had been married and they had nieces and nephews now. One thing that happened when they were gone is their queen had died.
No, rip.
And there was a new king in Tonga. And so, like, and he was very, very new. And so this new king in Tonga reached out to Peter Warner, the captain of the ship that found these boys. And he was like, hey, you rescued six of my subjects from certain death. Like, is there anything I can do for you? He was like, actually, yeah. I would like to be able to catch lobster in your waters and start a business here in Tonga. Is that okay? And the king goes, yeah, right. Sure.
That's a nice king.
And so he went home, Peter Warner, he sails back home and he quits his day job and he buys a new boat. He's like, hey, fuck you guys, I got a new job in Tonga.
I'm gonna get lobster rich, bye-bye.
And he sails back to Tonga. And he hires all six of the boys.
No, because they're friends now.
To work as a crew on his boat.
Yes.
Where they sailed the seas of Tonga and didn't get stranded on an island.
Oh, I love that. I love them.
So that, I am just dying over here. That's great.
So that, my friend, is the story of what can happen when schoolboys are stranded on an island. It's easy to believe that when our basest instincts are there, we would be reduced to savagery. But it came down to it for these six young men from Tonga. Their perseverance and their camaraderie is a very real testament to the strength of the human spirit. And most importantly, shows us the one ship that you cannot sink is friendship.
No! Oh, boo! No!
Yes!
I hate it here. I'm quitting the pod.
Big fan of the pod.
Ready? Mine is mercifully short, so you guys are welcome. Do you guys know the phrase, you're not dead until you're warm and dead?
Yep.
No.
You've never heard? So it's essentially like when someone gets hypothermia or gets any sort of something like that, like they're stuck in a snowstorm or they get underwater, you're not technically dead in a hospital unless you are at 98.6 and dead.
So yeah, I don't think it's just about being like hypothermic. Just, you're not dead until your room temperature and death.
Exactly, yeah. So if something happens to you and your body temperature is too low, they bring it back up and then they can declare you dead. Otherwise, it's like, we don't know yet.
Because if you're frozen, we can bring it back.
Oh, yeah, just like whole cellular shit. Like,
yeah.
You know, like if things are colder, they move slower, and like maybe we bring you back up to normal speed and then see how you do.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I get it.
Cool, so we're going to talk about that. So, on the night of December 20th, 1980, 19-year-old Jean Hillard had gone to town to have some drinks with her pals. So, on her way back at about midnight, she takes a shortcut, and it's been snowing, and it's really, really icy on this road. The car that she had wasn't super great on the road, so she ends up in a ditch. She's totally fine. She's not hurt or anything, but she's like, okay, it's the time before cell phones, 1980, right? So she's like, I either stay in this car and I freeze or I walk. She was about, give or take, 2 miles from her friend's house. It's her boyfriend's best friend. And she was like, okay, I think I can make it from here. I'm going to try.
How did people live before cell phones?
Oh, also, honestly, like, I didn't really hear the year that you said right away. So I kind of pictured it like Mulholland Drive. Like, they were, fully sliding some, like, big-ass 50s cars, 60s cars.
And there's some creepy dude behind the fucking...
No, this is her dad's, like... pickup truck. This is like not that cool. But so she's, yeah, like I said, about 2 miles away from her friend's house, and she's like, I think I can make it. I'm gonna try. She's in cowboy boots and like a light jacket. Like, she's not dressed for the elements.
Classic girls of the bar.
Yeah, just classic.
Just classic.
Yeah. So she said she was walking and she kept sort of being like, oh, I thought it was closer. So like after every hill, she was like, oh, I thought this was it, but I guess it's not. She was sort of further back than she initially thought. But she was like more frustrated than scared. Like, she was like, I'll be okay, right? So yeah, at the end of this 2 miles, she sees her friend's house. She's like, oh, thank God, I'm finally there. She gets just about to the driveway. Everything goes black. Yeah. So then next morning, her boyfriend's best friend, whose house she was in front of, his name is Wally Nelson, which I was like,
Wally Nelson?
Come on, man.
He sounds like he fucks.
I had the biggest crush on Wally Nelson in high school.
Big time.
I will tell you, he does fuck. So it's 7 a.m. He looks outside, you know, he's like, what's up? Gonna stave off this hangover. Let's go, like, you know, be in the snow for a second. And he sees this kind of like lump. It's covered in snow, and he's like,
Oh no.
He goes, oh no, like a deer died on my lawn.
It wasn't a deer, was it?
It was not a deer. So he goes up, he like brushes the snow off, and he's like, oh shit, this is a human person, and this is a girl I know. Like, it's his friend's girlfriend. So like, he's like, they were out together the night before at the bar. So he's like, oh my God, this is Jean, I know her, Jesus. So he goes to be like, I gotta help her. But at this point, she's like, frozen, like hard, eyes open, frozen. He was like, it was the creepiest thing I've ever seen in my life. He couldn't tell.
So did he just let it go?
He couldn't tell if she's alive, but then he saw like a couple of sort of like bubbles sort of coming out of her nose, and he's like, okay, that means breathing, that means alive. Well, okay, we gotta get out of the hospital. So he goes to put her in the cab of his truck, but she's too stiff and frozen that she won't like bend, and he doesn't want to hurt her. So he goes to the girl that's in his bed, who's the girl he picked up from the bar last night, and he's like, hey, we gotta help my friend.
I just might have found a corpse. Yeah. Hey, listen,
you're a bit of an Anna and she's a bit of an Elsa. We'll figure it out.
He really did think she was, like, going to die. He was like, there's no way.
Hey, babe, it's not gonna be a good big thing. We can still get brunch, but...
can we drive this there's a bit corpse of a thing to in the hospital? Yeah, so he takes her, like, popsicle body and basically puts it in this girl's car. And this girl who he took off from the bar, who he did not know, had to drive them to the hospital. hospital. And she was like, don't call me after this.
I think, I don't know, like, I think I might have put girls through worse. It's not that bad. At least she gets a good story out of it.
Yeah, and also, like anybody who's reasonable, not really your fault, you know?
Yeah, you didn't expect to have a corpse frozen with her eyes open in your door. Anyway, so they get to the hospital.
Although, maybe not have those loser buddies, you know, one time.
True. Yeah, so they get to the hospital, and the doctors were like, she's not going to make it. There's no possible way. They're doing that flashlight test where they're trying to get her pupils to react. Nothing.
And she's frozen to shit.
And she's absolutely frozen as hell. They keep trying to put IVs into her arm, but the needles are breaking on her, like, frozen skin.
Oh my god.
Yeah, bad, bad, bad sign, obviously. They were saying she was breathing shallowly 2 or 3 times a minute, which is not enough. And they said her heartbeat...
I think if you've done yoga, that's pretty good.
If you did Shavasana.
Yeah.
But they were saying her heart was beating 8 times a minute. I think, like, a normal healthy heartbeat is between, like, 60 and 100, give or take. So 8 is, like, not good. But it indicated...
It's at least beating.
That's what they indicated, a sign of life. So they're, okay, she's not all the way frozen. Dr. George Sather, who was, like, her kind of head of her medical team, basically said, like, I thought she was dead, but we picked up the faintest whimper, and we knew there was a person existing in there. He was like, this person wants to live. That's very clear, because her heart is still beating, even though she's frozen. So her chances of survival were not high, obviously, and her body temperature was so low, it didn't register on a thermometer when they were trying to take her temperature. They couldn't, her jaw was, like, frozen shut. They couldn't open it, so they were trying to do, like, those skin ones that you do. It wouldn't even register.
Sorry, what? Those skin ones?
Those, you, like, can, like, you know, laser it on or whatever. They're trying to do that. They were trying to into her ear. Like, they were trying to just take her temperature in any, essentially, orifice, but she was so frozen they couldn't do it.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're going to get to this. Like, was she conscious through all of this?
We will get around to it.
Okay.
Spoiler, she was not.
Okay.
She's got no memory of any of this, thank god. The last thing she
remembers... Spoiler alert, she made it.
Spoiler, she lives. The last thing she remembers is passing out in the driveway. There's nothing until she kind of wakes up later in the hospital. So, like, thank god for that. But yeah, they basically decided to, like, pray for a miracle and just, like, see how it goes. So they sort of put all these heating blankets around her. In nowadays time, not in 1980s, like, rural Midwest.
Not a good idea.
Well, no, so now they have these machines where you can, like,
that
hook
up.
That
was 41 years ago.
Yeah. So it was, they can hook up these machines to you, basically, that slowly warm your blood through, like, putting heated blood and, like, heated liquid through you. It just slowly warms you up.
Like a lizard just sitting on a heated rock.
Exactly like that. But at this point, they just had heating pads, and they'd never, at this specific hospital, this specific group of doctors had never done this before. So they were kind of like, we really hope this works, but it very might. Much might not. They told her parents, like, when and if she wakes up, which, like, she probably won't, she'll have irreparable brain damage and we'll have to amputate her legs. So, like, just be prepared for what you're about to deal with. And the parents are like, yeah, okay, warm her up. We want our kid back. So by mid-morning, Jean is having, like, these, like, spasms, like, really scary. Not, like, seizures, but kind of, like, it's, like, life coming back into her body almost. By noon, she is awake and talking. She's asking for water.
What?
She's asking for a drink of water, and she's very worried that her dad is going to be mad because she left the car in the ditch.
So she remembers everything from before the
bananas.
Her cognitive function's entirely intact. No brain damage after being frozen nearly solid for 7 hours. No brain damage, just completely back to normal.
Is she why we can, like, now people are freezing themselves and being like, hey, resuscitate this later?
Right? It's insane.
Ted Williams, that must have been his inspiration.
Yeah.
So yeah, by the end of the first day that she had woken up, she was moving her arms, and by day 3, she was moving her legs, which they thought they were going to have to amputate, because they were like, these things are gone. There's no way her and her little cowboy boots made it even through the night. So, the doctors are like, well, this is a medical miracle. Like, there's no way. Like, do you guys know what frostbite is? Like, do you understand what it is cellularly in the body?
No.
Okay, so basically frostbite is, like, it gets so cold that the cells will burst, meaning that, like, even if you medically intervene, those cells are gone. They've exploded. They can't be repaired.
They've died.
They've died, exactly. So that's why you have to, like, lose bits of toes and ears and, like, noses and stuff. It's because those cells are gone. They're beyond medical repair. So they thought... But they thought she was going to have permanent frostbite, like, minimum ears, nose, fingers, toes, kind of the basics. She didn't have any of that. Also, this girl was throws in with her eyes wide open, eyes famously full of liquid.
Gosh, right.
No issues, no blindness, no sight damage at all.
What? Wow.
Just froze slowly and was fine about it.
Also, when I said for now earlier, I've been watching a lot of Star Trek Deep Space Nine lately. That's just how the future feels to me.
Totally. Totally. She ended up having to do a couple of skin grafts just to, like, cover a couple of things that got a little bit of frostbite, but she managed to keep all of her limbs, everything fine, really minimal surgery. I don't have a picture of her now because I didn't think, but if you look at her now, no visible scars at all. She just looks like a normal woman who had a normal life and didn't almost fucking freeze to death.
Is she hot?
She was hot, for sure. Yeah, yeah. 19-year-old Jean. Like, very cold. Frozen Jean. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Some cold fox.
So it was funny because when she was in the hospital, her parents were super Christian, right? So they, right before she sort of woke up, they called this prayer chain into action, which is like they call other church people and they all pray and stuff. Yeah. It's very sweet. And so they're all praying for her. And then when she comes back to life, kind of unharmed, they took that as like a proof of God. Like, sorry, our kid was a popsicle and now she's fine. Like, they really were like, this is it. This is, you know, proof. We were right. We picked the right religion. And So when Jean got out of the hospital...
They were probably right. No bad things ever came out of that.
None.
Christianity, huh? So 49 days later, when she was all the way fully healed and all the way good to go, Jean got to leave the hospital totally intact. And then she went on to do, like... she would go to churches and do, like, motivational speeches and things, being like, hey, if I survived literally freezing, you can get through whatever the hell you're dealing with. Like, buck up, essentially. she went to New York and she got interviewed by Tom Brokaw. She'd never been to New York before, so that was like super exciting. She brought her mom. It was a whole thing. But yeah, so now she's just a married lady who lives a relatively normal life.
After being human pops.
Like,
other than the midnight screamings.
The fact that she is so undamaged is what's shocking to me. The fact she got zero brain damage, like
that we
all
know.
Of her... Well, she knows she's, like, fine. Like, they've done 1,000 tests, and she's chill. And the fact that her fingers are also there, it's so crazy to me.
But every time that she has a test, her husband shows up with a bloody nose, and nobody knows why.
But, I mean, like, you can get frostbite so easily. Like, the fact that she's okay is insane. So,
Yeah, you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
You're not dead until you're warm and dead. She was never warm and dead. But, yeah, she talks about, it's funny, she talks about when she was, you know, dead, quote-unquote, she was like, yeah, I didn't see a lighter. I didn't meet Jesus or anything, so that's kind of a disappointment, which I thought was really, that was really funny. And that, like, sweet Midwestern accent, I was just sort of like, oh, I didn't.
It was like, I guess I might not have been dead because I didn't meet Jesus. I must not have been dead.
Exactly.
Well, her doctor's like, ooh, this is a very, very dead human.
She said, well, no, I didn't meet the Lord, so no way.
You know what? All those doctors were Democrats. Thanks, Obama.
It was a speedy story of how Jean Hilliard nearly froze to death and yet somehow walked away without any injuries.
Literally walked away.
At all. Walked away clean.
And you are not dead until you are...
warm and dead. That's our second guest episode. I hope you guys had a lovely time.
Oh, we do have to do that whole thing.
We do have to do the thing, yeah, where we say thanks to our pals. Okay, so let's talk about some stuff. You can find me on Instagram at @_BonJordan. It's a French pun. It's very funny. We never get tired of it. Colby is... at bars.and.blades. He never says the dots. You can follow him on that. He's very good. He's got good stuff. Tyler, you want to plug your stuff?
I have so much to plug, Jordan. Go for it. So I'm not going to tell you who I am on Instagram. And also, I have nothing coming up because I work for the man. But
is there anything that you would encourage our listeners to go look into or donate towards?
The first thing is I would say to look into any All Child Matters cause that you can, and just like throw it. It's happening in your community if you live in Canada. If not, then look into it on the internet, but like, should be pretty simple for you. Okay, so these guys are going to put a link in the bio for the Every Child Matters movement, and you should throw some money at that, especially if you're white.
No kidding.
That's entirely fair.
Okay, friends, give us a follow. Oh, we're also at SIDK Pod if you want to check that out.
You can find us on
TikTok. Same thing. And Instagram. Yep. So yeah, give us a follow and we hope you like this one and we will see you next week. Okay, bye, friends.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.